his own frosty in place in front of Luther Crank's chimney, on Luther's roof, in the snow and the cold, when he saw the green flashing light from the end of the street. "Here they come," he yelled down to Crank's patio, where his assistant Judd Bellington was waiting by the ladder and trying to repair the strap. From Ralph's point of view, he watched with some measure of pride and some measure of frustration, because it was cold up there and getting colder, as his neighborhood circled the wagons to help one of its own, even if it was Luther Crank. A large choir, under the shaky direction of Mrs. Ellen Mulholland, was assembled next to the driveway and began singing Jingle Bells. Linda Galdi owned a set of handbells, and her hurriedly recruited band began ringing them along with the choir. The front lawn was covered with neighborhood children, all waiting eagerly for Blair and her mysterious new fiancé. When the police car slowed in front of the Cranks, a cheer went up, a loud hello from the kids on Hemlock. "My goodness," Blair said, "what a crowd." There was a fire truck parked in front of the Beckers and a large lime-green ambulance in front of the Trogdons, and on cue all their lights began flashing to welcome Blair. When the police cars rolled to a stop in the driveway, Vic Frohmeyer himself yanked open the front door. "Merry Christmas, Blair," he boomed. She and Enrique were soon on the front lawn, surrounded by dozens of neighbors while the choir howled away. Blair introduced Enrique, who seemed just a bit bewildered by the reception. They made their way onto the front steps and into the living room, where another cheer went up. At Nora's request, four firemen and three cops stood shoulder to shoulder in front of the tree, trying to block as much of it as possible from Blair's view. Luther and Nora waited nervously in their bedroom for a private reunion with their daughter and for a quiet introduction to Enrique. "What if we don't like him?" Luther mumbled, sitting on the edge of the bed, rubbing his ankles. The party was growing rowdy down the hall. "Hush, Luther. We raised a smart girl." Nora was applying a last-minute layer of powder to her cheeks. "But they just met. Love at first sight." "That's impossible." "Maybe you're right. It took me 3 years to see your potential." The door opened and Blair rushed in. Nora and Luther both glanced at her first, then quickly looked beyond to see how dark Enrique was. He wasn't dark at all, at least two shades lighter than Luther himself. They hugged and squeezed their daughter as if she'd been gone for years, then, with great relief, met their future son-in-law. "You guys look great," Blair said, sizing them up. Nora was wearing a bulky Christmas sweater, the first time in memory that she wanted to look heavier. Luther was the aging gigolo. "Been watching our weight," he said, still pumping Enrique's hand. "You've been in the sun," Blair said to Luther. "Well, yes, we've had some unseasonably warm weather, actually. Got a bit burned in the flower beds last weekend." "Let's get to the party," Nora said. "Can't keep folks waiting," Luther added, leading the way. "Isn't he handsome?" Blair whispered to her mother. Enrique was just a step ahead. "Very handsome," Nora said proudly. "Why is Daddy limping?" "Hurt his foot. He's fine." The living room was packed with people. A different sort of crowd, Blair noticed, not that it mattered. Most of the regulars were not there. Most of the neighbors were, and she couldn't figure out why the police and firemen had been invited. There were some gifts for Enrique, which he opened in the center of the room. Ned Becker passed along a red golf shirt from a local country club. John Galdi had just been given a picture book of local country inns. His wife rewrapped it, and they unloaded it on Enrique, who was moved almost to tears. The fireman gave him two fruitcakes, though he confessed they didn't have such delights down in Peru. The Police Benevolent Association gave him a calendar. "His English is perfect," Nora whispered to Blair. "Better than mine," she whispered back. "I thought you'd said he'd never been to the U.S. He was educated in London." "Oh." And Enrique went up another notch. "Handsome, educated abroad, a doctor." "Where did you meet him?" "In Lima, during orientation." A cheer went up as Enrique opened a tall box and removed a lava lamp, one passed along by the Bellingtons. When the gifts were done, Luther announced, "Dinner," and the crowd moved to the kitchen where the table was covered with the Hemlock leftovers, though the food had been arranged and rearranged until it looked original and festive. Even Nora's smoked trout had been dressed up by Jessica Brixley, perhaps the best chef on the street. The carolers were frozen and tired of the snow, though it wasn't heavy. They heard the news about dinner and moved inside along with Mrs. Linda Galdi's handbell ensemble. The man with the orange and gray beard Nora had met by the peanut butter at Kroger appeared from nowhere and seemed to know everyone, though no one seemed to know him. Nora welcomed him and watched him carefully, and finally heard him introduce himself as Marty somebody. Marty loved a gathering and quickly warmed to the occasion. He cornered Enrique over cake and ice cream, and the two immediately launched into an extended conversation, in Spanish no less. "Who is that?" Luther whispered as he limped by. "Marty," Nora whispered back, as if she'd known him for years. When everyone had eaten, they drifted back to the living room where a fire was roaring. The children sang two carols, then Marty stepped forward with a guitar. Enrique stepped forward, too, and explained that he and his new friend would like to sing a couple of traditional Peruvian Christmas songs. Marty attacked the guitar with a vengeance, and the duet began in a nice harmony. The words were unknown to the audience, but the message was clear. Christmas was a time of joy and peace around the world. "He sings, too," Nora whispered to Blair, who just radiated. Between songs, Marty explained that he'd once worked in Peru and that singing the songs made him miss the place. Enrique took the guitar, strummed a few chords, then softly began another carol. Luther leaned on the mantel, alternating one foot at a time, smiling gamely, though he wanted to lie down and sleep forever. He looked at the faces of his neighbors, all of whom were entranced with the music. They were all there, except for the Trogdons, and except for Walt and Bev Scheel. 20. After yet another foreign carol, and during a boisterous round of applause for the Enrique and Marty duet, Luther slipped unnoticed from the kitchen and eased through the darkness of his garage. Dressed in snow attire, overcoat, wool cap, muffler, boots, gloves, he shuffled along, aided by the plastic cane he'd vowed not to use, trying not to wince with each step, though both ankles were swollen and raw. The cane was in his right hand, a large envelope in his left. The snow was still light, but the ground was covered. At the sidewalk, he turned and gazed upon the gathering in his living room, a packed house, a tree that improved with the distance. Above them, a borrowed Frosty. Hemlock was quiet. The fire truck and ambulance and police cars were gone, thankfully. Luther looked east and west and saw not a single person moving about. Most of them were in his house, singing along now, rescuing him from an episode that would undoubtedly be remembered as one of his more curious. The Scheel house was well lit on the outside, but almost completely dark within. Luther crept up their driveway, his boots rubbing his wounds, the cane making the entire venture possible. On their porch, he rang the doorbell and looked again at his house directly across the street. Ralph Brixley and Judd Bellington came around the corner, hurriedly stringing lights on Luther's boxwoods. He closed his eyes for a second, shook his head, looked at his feet. Walt Scheel answered the door with a pleasant, "Well, Merry Christmas, Luther." "And Merry Christmas to you," Luther said with a genuine smile. "You're missing your party." "Just have a second, Walt. Could I step in?" "Of course." Luther limped into the foyer where he parked himself on a mat. His boots had accumulated snow, and he didn't want to leave tracks. Something was baking in the kitchen, and Luther took that as a good sign. "No, thanks. How's Bev?" "She's having a good day, thanks. We started to come over and see Blair, but the snow started. So, how's the fiancé?" "A very nice young man," Luther said. Bev Scheel entered from the dining room and said hello and Merry Christmas. She was wearing a red holiday sweater and looked the same, as far as Luther could tell. Rumor was that her doctor had given her 6 months. "Pretty nasty fall," Walt said with a smile. "Could have been worse," Luther said, grinning, trying to enjoy himself as the butt of the joke. "We won't dwell on that subject," he declared to himself. He cleared his throat and said, "Look, Blair's here for 10 days, so we won't be taking the cruise. Nora and I would like for you guys to have it." He lifted the envelope slightly, sort of waved it at them. Their reaction was delayed as glances were exchanged, thoughts were attempted. They were stunned, and for quite a spell couldn't speak, so Luther plowed ahead. "The flight leaves at noon tomorrow. You'll need to get there early to get the names changed and such, a slight hassle, but it'll be worth it. I've already called my travel agency this afternoon. 10 days in the Caribbean, beaches, islands, the works. It'll be a dream vacation." Walt shook his head no, but just slightly. Bev's eyes were moist. Neither could speak until Walt managed to say, with little conviction, "We can't take it, Luther. It's not right." Don't be silly. I didn't purchase the travel insurance, so if you don't go, then the entire package is wasted. Bev looked at Walt, who was already looking at her, and when their eyes locked, Luther caught it. It was crazy, but why not?
I'm not sure my doctor will allow it, she said feebly.
I've got that Lexan deal on the front burner, Walt mumbled to himself as he scratched his head.
And we promised the Shorts we'd be there New Year's Eve, Bev added, sort of musing.
Benny said he might drop in. Benny was their oldest son, who hadn't been home in years.
And what about the cat? Bev asked.
Luther let them shuffle and strain, and when they ran out of their flimsy excuses, he said, It's a gift from us to you, a sincere, heartfelt, no-strings-attached Christmas offering to two people who are at this very moment having a difficult time finding an excuse. Just go for it, okay?
I'm not sure I have the right clothes, Bev said, predictably,
to which Walt replied, Don't be ridiculous. With their resistance crumbling, Luther moved in for the kill. He shoved the envelope at Walt. It's all here. Airline tickets, cruise passes, brochures, everything, including the phone number of the travel agency. What's the cost, Luther? If we go, then we'll reimburse you. It's a simple gift, Walt. No cost, no payback. Don't make it complicated. Walt understood, but his pride got in his way. We'll just have to discuss it when we get back. There. They were already gone and back. We can talk about everything then.
What about the cat? Bev asked.
Walt pinched his chin in serious thought and said, Yes, that's a real problem. Too late to call the kennel. With uncanny timing, a large black furry cat sneaked into the foyer, rubbed itself on Walt's right leg, then gave a long look up at Luther.
We can't just leave him, Bev was saying.
No, we can't, Walt said. Luther hated cats.
We could ask Jude Becker, Bev said.
No problem, I'll take care of him, Luther said, swallowing hard, knowing perfectly well that Nora would get the chore.
Are you sure? Walt asked, a little too quickly.
No problem. The cat took another look at Luther and slunk away. The feeling was mutual. The goodbyes took much longer than the hellos, and when Luther hugged Bev, he thought she would break. Under the bulky sweater was a frail and ailing woman. The tears were halfway down her cheeks.
I'll call Nora, she whispered.
Thanks. Old tough-as-nails Walt had moist eyes, too. On the front steps during their last handshake, he said, This means so much, Luther.
Thank you.
When the shields were once again locked away inside, Luther started home. Unburdened by the thick envelope now, shed of its pricey tickets and thick brochures, freed of all the self-indulgence contained therein, his steps were a little quicker. And filled with the satisfaction of making the perfect gift, Luther walked straight and proud with hardly a limp. At the street, he stopped and looked over his shoulder. The Shields' home, dark as a cave just moments earlier, was now alive with lights being flipped on both upstairs and down. They'll pack all night, Luther thought to himself. A door opened across the street, and the Goldie family made a noisy exit from the Cranks' living room. Laughter and music escaped with them and echoed above Hemlock. The party showed little signs of breaking up. Standing there at the edge of the street, light snow gathering on his wool cap and collar, gazing at his freshly decorated house with almost the entire neighborhood packed into it, Luther paused to count his blessings. Blair was home, and she'd brought with her a very nice, handsome, polite young man who was quite obviously crazy about her, and who, at that moment, was very much in charge of the party, along with Marty what's-his-name. Luther himself was lucky to be standing, as opposed to lying peacefully on a slab at Franklin's funeral home, or pinned to a bed in ICU at Mercy Hospital, tubes running everywhere. Thoughts of snowballing down his roof headfirst still horrified him. Very lucky indeed. Blessed with friends and neighbors who would sacrifice their plans for Christmas Eve to rescue him, he looked up to his chimney where the Brixley's Frosty was watching him. Round, smiling face. Top hat. Corncob pipe. Through the flurries, Luther thought he caught a wink from the snowman. Starving, as usual, Luther suddenly craved smoked trout. He began trekking through the snow. I'll eat a fruitcake, too, he vowed to himself. Skipping Christmas. What a ridiculous idea. Maybe next year. This is Dennis Boutsakaris. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Skipping Christmas by John Grisham. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2001 by Belfry Holdings Incorporated. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.